Francie saw the Tinmore girls standing together in their doorway, their gray hair in crimpers and ruffled starched nightgowns showing under their voluminous wrappers. They added their thin, poignant voices to Johnny's. Floss Gaddis, her mother, and her brother Henny, who was dying of consumption, stood in their doorway. Henny was crying, and when Johnny saw him, he let the song trail off. He thought maybe it made Henny too sad. Flossie was in costume waiting for an escort to take her to a masquerade ball, which started soon after midnight. She stood there in her Klondike dance hall girl costume, with sheer black silk stockings, spool-heeled slippers, one red garter fastened under a knee, and swinging a black mask in her hand. She smiled into Johnny's eyes. She put her hand on her hip and leaned seductively, or so she thought, against the door jamb. "More to make Henny smile than anything else," Johnny said. "Floss, we got no angel for the top of this Christmas tree. How about you obliging?" Floss was all ready to make a dirty reply about the wind blowing her drawers off if she was up that high. But she changed her mind. There was something about the big, proud tree, now so humble in its being dragged. Something about the beaming children. Something about the rare goodwill of the neighbors and the way the lights looked turned low in the halls that made her ashamed of her unspoken reply. All she said was, "Gee, ain't you the kidda, Johnny Nolan?" Katie stood alone on the top of the last flight of steps with her hands clasped before her. She listened to the singing. She looked down and watched their slow progress up the stairs. She was thinking deeply. "They think this is so good," she thought. "They think it's good, the tree they got for nothing, and their father playing up to them, and the singing and the way the neighbors are happy. They think they're mighty lucky that they're living and that it's Christmas again. They can't see that we live on a dirty street, in a dirty house among people who aren't much good. Johnny and the children can't see how pitiful it is that our neighbors have to make happiness out of this filth and dirt. My children must get out of this. They must come to more than Johnny or me or all these people around us. But how is this to come about? Reading a page from those books every day and saving pennies in the tin can bank isn't enough. Money. Would that make it better for them? Yes, it would make it easy. But no, the money wouldn't be enough. McGarity owns the saloon standing on the corner, and he has a lot of money. His wife wears diamond earrings. But her children are not as good and smart as my children. They are mean and greedy towards others because they have the things to taunt poor children with. I have seen the McGarity girl eating from a bag of candy on the street, while a ring of hungry children watched her. I saw those children looking at her and crying in their hearts. And when she couldn't eat any more, she threw the rest down the sewer rather than give it to them. Ah, no, it isn't the money alone. The McGarity girl wears a different hair bow each day, and they cost 50 cents apiece, and that would feed the four of us here for one day. But her hair is thin and pale red. My Neely has a big hole in his zitful cap, and it's stretched out of shape, but he has thick, deep, golden hair that curls. My Francie wears no hair bow, but her hair is long and shining. Can money buy things like that? No. That means there must be something bigger than money. Miss Jackson teaches at the settlement house, and she has no money. She works for charity. She lives in a little room there on the top floor. She only has the one dress, but she keeps it clean and pressed. Her eyes look straight into yours when you talk with her. When you listen to her, it's like you used to be sick, but hearing her voice, it's making you well again. She knows about things, Miss Jackson. She understands about things. She can live in the middle of a dirty neighborhood and be fine and clean and like an actress in a play. Someone you can look at but who is too fine to touch. There is that difference between her and Mrs. McGarity, who has so much money but is too fat and acts in a dirty way with the truck drivers who deliver her husband's beer. So what is this difference between her and this Miss Jackson who has no money? An answer came to Katie. It was so simple that a flash of astonishment that felt like pain shot through her head. Education. That was it. It was education that made the difference. Education would pull them out of the grime and dirt. Proof? Miss Jackson was educated. The McGarity wasn't. Ah, that's what Mary Romilly, her mother, had been telling her all those years. Only her mother did not have the one clear word. Education. watching the children struggling up the stairs with their tree, listening to their voices, still so baby-like. She got these ideas about education. Francie is smart, she thought. She must go to high school, and maybe beyond that. She's a learner, and she'll be somebody someday. But when she gets educated, she will grow away from me. Why, she's growing away from me now. She does not love me the way the boy loves me. I feel her turn away from me. She does not understand me. All she understands is that I don't understand her. Maybe when she gets education, she will be ashamed of me, the way I talk. But she will have too much character to show it. Instead, she will try to make me different. She will come to see me and try to make me live in a better way. And I will be mean to her because I'll know she's above me. She will figure out too much about things as she grows older. She'll get to know too much for her own happiness. She'll find out that I don't love her as much as I love the boy. I cannot help it that this is so. But she won't understand that. Sometimes, I think she knows that now. Already she is growing away from me. She will fight to get away soon. Changing over to that faraway school was the first step in her getting away from me. But Neely will never leave me. That is why I love him best. He will cling to me and understand me. I want him to be a doctor. He must be a doctor. Maybe he will play the fiddle, too. There is music in him. He got that from his father. He has gone further on the piano than Francie or me. Yes, his father has the music in him, but it does him no good. It is ruining him. If he couldn't sing, those men who treat him to drinks wouldn't want him around. What good is the fine way he can sing when it doesn't make him or us any better? With the boy, it will be different. He'll be educated. I must think out ways. We'll not have Johnny with us long. Dear God, I loved him so much once. And sometimes, I still do. But he's worthless. Worthless. And God forgive me for ever finding it out. Thus Katie figured out everything in the moments it took them to climb the stairs. People looking up at her, at her smooth, pretty, vivacious face, had no way of knowing about the painfully articulated resolves formulating in her mind. They set the tree up in the front room after spreading a sheet to protect the carpet of pink roses from falling pine needles. The tree stood in a big tin bucket with broken bricks to hold it upright. When the rope was cut away, the branches spread out to fill the whole room. They draped over the piano, and it was so that some of the chairs stood among the branches. There was no money to buy tree decorations or lights, but the great tree standing there was enough. The room was cold. It was a poor year, that one, too poor for them to buy the extra coal for the front room stove. The room smelt cold and clean and aromatic. Every day during the week the tree stood there. Francie put on her sweater and zitful cap and went in and sat under the tree. She sat there and enjoyed the smell and the dark greenness of it. Oh, the mystery of a great tree, a prisoner in a tin wash bucket, in a tenement front room. Poor as they were that year, it was a very nice Christmas, and the children did not lack for gifts. Mama gave each of them a pair of long woolen drawers, drop-seat style, and a woolen shirt with long sleeves and itchy insides. Aunt Evie gave them a joint present, a box of dominoes. Papa showed them how to play. Neely didn't like the game, so Papa and Francie played together, and he pretended to be disgusted when he lost. Grandma Mary Romilly brought over something very nice that she had made herself. She brought each a scapular. To make it, she cut out two small ovals of bright red wool. On one, she embroidered a cross of bright blue yarn, and on the other, a golden heart crowned with brown thorns. A black dagger went through the heart, and two drops of deep red blood dripped from the dagger point. The cross and heart were very tiny and made with microscopic stitches. The two ovals were stitched together and attached to a piece of corset string. Mary Romilly had taken the scapulars to be blessed by the priest before she brought them over. As she slipped the scapular over Francie's head, she said, "Heiliges Weihnachten." Then she added, "May you walk with the angels, always." Aunt Sissy gave Francie a tiny package. She opened it and found a tiny matchbox. It was very fragile and covered with crinkly paper with a miniature spray of purple wisteria painted on the top. Francie pushed the box open. It held 10 discs, individually wrapped in pink tissue. The discs turned out to be bright golden pennies. Sissy explained that she had bought a bit of gold paint powder, mixed it with a few drops of banana oil, and had gilded each penny. Francie loved Sissy's present the best of all. A dozen times within the hour of receiving it, she slid open the box slowly, gaining great pleasure from holding the box, and looking at it and watching the cobalt blue paper and the clean wafer-thin wood of the inside of the box appear. The golden pennies wrapped in the dreamlike tissue were a never-tiring miracle. Everyone agreed that the pennies were too beautiful to be spent. During the day, Francie lost two of her pennies somewhere. Mama suggested they'd be safest in the tin can bank. She promised that Francie could have them back when the bank was opened. Francie was sure that Mama was right about the pennies being safest in the bank, yet it was a wrench to let those golden pennies drop down into the darkness. Papa had a special present for Francie. It was a postcard with a church on it. Powdered isinglass was pasted on the roof, and it glistened more brightly than real snow. The church window panes were made of tiny squares of shiny orange paper. The magic in this card was that when Francie held it up, light streamed through the paper panes and threw golden shadows on the glistening snow. It was a beautiful thing. Mama said that since it wasn't written on, Francie could save it for next year and mail it to someone. "Oh, no," said Francie. She put both hands over the card and held it to her chest. Mama laughed. "You must learn to take a joke, Francie, otherwise life will be pretty hard on you." "Christmas is no day for lessons," said Papa. "But it is a day for getting drunk, isn't it?" she flared up. "Two drinks is all I had, Katie," Johnny pleaded. "I was treated for Christmas." Francie went into the bedroom and shut the door. She couldn't bear to hear Mama scolding Papa. Just before supper, Francie distributed the gifts she had for them. She had a hatpin holder for Mama. She had made it with a penny test tube bought at Knipe's drugstore. She had covered it with a sheath of blue satin ribbon ruffled at the sides. A length of baby ribbon was sewn to the top. It was meant to hang on the side of the dresser and hold hatpins. She had a watch fob for Papa. She had made it on a spool which had four nails driven into the top. It took two shoelaces. These were worked over and around the nails, and a thick braided fob kept growing out of the bottom of the spool as she worked it. Johnny had no watch, but he took an iron faucet washer, attached the fob to it, and wore it in his vest pocket all day, pretending it was a watch. Francie had a very fine present for Neely, a 5-cent shooter which looked like an oversized opal rather than a marble. Neely had a box full of midges, small brown and blue speckled marbles made of clay which cost a penny for 20. But he had no good shooter and couldn't get into any important games. Francie watched him as he crooked his forefinger and cradled the marble in it with his thumb behind it. It looked nice and natural that way, and she was glad she had got it for him rather than the nickel pop gun she had first thought of buying. Neely shut the marble in his pocket and announced that he had presents too. He ran into the bedroom, crawled under his cot, and came out with a sticky bag. He thrust it at Mama, saying, "You share them out." He stood in a corner. Mama opened the bag. There was a striped candy cane for each one. Mama went into ecstasies. She said it was the prettiest present she had ever had. She kissed Neely 3 times. Francie tried very hard not to be jealous, because Mama made more fuss over Neely's present than hers. It was in that same week that Francie told another great lie. Aunt Evie brought over 2 tickets. Some Protestant organization was giving a celebration for the poor of all faiths. There would be a decorated Christmas tree on the stage, a Christmas play, carol singing, and a gift for each child. Katie couldn't see it, Catholic children at a Protestant party. Evie urged tolerance. Mama finally gave in, and Francie and Neely went to the party. It was in a large auditorium. The boys sat on one side, and the girls on the other. The celebration was fine, except that the play was religious and dull. After the play, church ladies went down the aisle and gave each child a gift. All the girls got checkerboards, and all the boys got lotto games. After a little more singing, a lady came out on the stage and announced a special surprise. The surprise was a lovely little girl, exquisitely dressed, who came from the wings carrying a beautiful doll. The doll was a foot high, had real yellow hair and blue eyes that opened and shut with real eyelashes. The lady led the child forward and made a speech. "This little girl is named Mary." Little Mary smiled and bowed. The little girls in the audience smiled up at her, and some of the boys who were approaching adolescence whistled shrilly. "Mary's mother bought this doll and had clothes made for it, just like the clothes little Mary is wearing." Little Mary stepped forward and held the doll high in the air. Then she let the lady hold it while she spread her skirt and made a curtsy. It was true, saw Francie. The doll's lace-trimmed blue silk dress, pink hair bow, black patent leather slippers, and white silk socks duplicated exactly the clothes of the beautiful Mary. "Now," said the lady, "this doll is named Mary, after the kind little girl who is giving her away." Again the little girl smiled graciously. "Mary wants to give the doll to some poor little girl in the audience who is named Mary." Like wind on growing corn, a rippling murmur came from all the little girls in the audience. "Is there any poor little girl in the audience named Mary?" There was a great hush. There were at least 100 Marys in that audience. It was that adjective poor that struck them dumb. No Mary would stand up, no matter how much she wanted the doll, and be a symbol of all the poor little girls in the audience. They began whispering to each other that they weren't poor and had better dolls home and better clothes than that girl, too, only they didn't feel like wearing them. Francie sat numb, longing for that doll with all her soul. "What?" said the lady. "No Marys?" She waited and made her announcement again. No response. She spoke regretfully. "Too bad there are no Marys. Little Mary will have to take the doll home again." The little girl smiled and bowed and turned to leave the stage with the doll. Francie couldn't stand it. She couldn't stand it. It was like when the teacher was going to throw the pumpkin pie in the wastebasket. She stood up and held her hand high in the air. The lady saw it and stopped the little girl from leaving the stage. "Ah, we do have a Mary. A very bashful Mary, but a Mary just the same. Come right up on the stage, Mary." Feverish with embarrassment, Francie walked up the long aisle and onto the stage. She stumbled on the steps, and all the girls snickered and the boys guffawed. "What is your name?" asked the lady.
"Mary Frances Nolan," whispered Francie.
"Louder, and look at the audience."
Miserably, Francie faced the audience and said loudly,
"Mary Frances Nolan."
All the faces looked like bloated balloons on thick strings. She thought that if she kept on looking, the faces would float away up to the ceiling. The beautiful girl came forward and put the doll in Francie's arms. Francie's arms took a natural curve around it. It was as if her arms had waited and grown so just for that doll. The beautiful Mary extended her hand for Francie to shake. In spite of embarrassment and confusion, Francie noticed the delicate white hand with the tracery of pale blue veins and the oval nails that glowed like delicate pink seashells. The lady talked as Francie backed awkwardly to her seat. She said, "You have all seen an example of the true Christmas spirit. Little Mary is a very rich little girl and received many beautiful dolls for Christmas. But she was not selfish. She wanted to make some poor little Mary, who is not as fortunate as herself, happy, so she gave the doll to that poor little girl who is named Mary, too." Francie's eyes smarted with hot tears.
"Why can't they,"
she thought bitterly,
"just give the doll away without saying I am poor and she is rich? Why couldn't they just give it away without all the talking about it?"
That was not all of Francie's shame. As she walked down the aisle, the girls leaned towards her and whispered hissingly, "Beggar! Beggar! Beggar!" It was beggar, beggar, beggar all the way down the aisle. Those girls felt richer than Francie. They were as poor as she, but they had something she lacked. Pride. And Francie knew it. She had no compunctions about the lie and getting the doll under false pretenses. She was paying for the lie and for the doll by giving up her pride. She remembered the teacher who had told her to write her lies instead of speaking them. Maybe she shouldn't have gone up for the doll, but she should have written a story about it instead. But no, no. Having the doll was better than any story about having a doll. When they stood to sing the Star-Spangled Banner in closing, Francie put her face down close to the doll's face.
There was the cool, delicate smell of painted china, the wonderful, unforgettable smell of a doll's hair, the heavenly feel of new gauze doll's clothes. The doll's real eyelashes touched her cheek, and she trembled in ecstasy. The children were singing, "O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." Francie held one of the doll's tiny hands tightly. A nerve in her thumb throbbed, and she thought the doll's hand twitched. She almost believed the doll was real. She told Mama the doll had been given to her as a prize. She dared not tell the truth. Mama hated anything that smacked of charity, and if she knew, she'd throw the doll away. Neely didn't snitch on her. Francie now owned the doll, but had yet another lie on her soul. That afternoon, she wrote a story about a little girl who wanted a doll so much that she was willing to give over her immortal soul to purgatory for eternity if she could have the doll. It was a strong story, but when Francie read it over, she thought, "That's all right for the girl in the story, but it doesn't make me feel any better." She thought of the confession she would have to make the next Saturday. She resolved that no matter what penance Father gave her, she would triple it voluntarily. Still, she felt no better. Then she remembered something. Maybe she could make the lie a truth. She knew that when Catholic children received confirmation, they were expected to take some saint's name for a middle name. What a simple solution. She would take the name of Mary when she was confirmed. That night, after the page from the Bible and the page from Shakespeare had been read, Francie consulted Mama. "Mama, when I make my confirmation, can I take Mary for a middle name?" "No." Francie's heart sunk.
"Why?"
"Because when you were christened, you were named Francie after Andy's girl."
"I know."
"But you were also named Mary after my mother. Your real name is Mary Frances Nolan."
Francie took the doll to bed with her. She lay very still so as not to disturb it. She woke up from time to time in the night and whispered, "Mary," and touched the doll's infinitesimal slipper with a light finger. She trembled at feeling the thin, soft bit of smooth leather. It was to be her first and her last doll. The future was a near thing to Katie. She had a way of saying, "Christmas will be here before you know it," or at the beginning of vacation, "School will be starting up before you know it." In the spring, when Francie discarded her long drawers and joyously flung them away, Mama made her pick them up again, saying, "You'll need them soon enough again. Winter will be here before you know it." What was Mama talking about? Spring had just started. The winter would never come again. A small child has little idea of the future. Next week is as far ahead as his future stretches, and the year between Christmas and Christmas again is an eternity. So time was with Francie up until her 11th year. Between her 11th and 12th birthday, things changed. The future came along quicker, the days seemed shorter, and the weeks seemed to have less days in them. Henny Gaddis died, and this had something to do with it. She had always heard that Henny was going to die. She heard about it so much that she finally got to believe he would die, but that would be a long, long time away. Now the long time had come. The something which had been a future was now a present, and would become a past. Francie wondered whether someone had to die to make that clear to a child. But no. Grandfather Romilly had died when she was 9, a week after she made her first communion, and as she remembered, Christmas still had seemed far away at that time. Things were changing so fast for Francie now that she got mixed up. Neely, who was a year younger than she, grew suddenly and got to be a head taller. Maudie Donovan moved away. When she returned on a visit 3 months later, Francie found her different. Maudie had developed in a womanly way during those 3 months. Francie, who knew Mama was always right, found out that she was wrong once in a while. She discovered that some of the things she loved so much in her father were considered very comical to other people. The scales at the tea store did not shine so brightly anymore, and she found the bins were chipped and shabby-looking. She stopped watching for Mr. Tominey to come home on Saturday nights from his New York jaunts. All of a sudden she thought it was silly that he lived so, and went to New York and came home longing for where he had been. He had money. Why didn't he just go over to New York and live there if he liked it so much? Everything was changing. Francie was in a panic. Her world was slipping away from her, and what would take its place? Still, what was different anyhow?
She read a page from the Bible and Shakespeare every night the same as always. She practiced the piano every day for an hour. She put pennies in the tin can bank. The junk shop was still there, the stores were all the same. Nothing was changing. She was the one who was changing. She told Papa about it. He made her stick out her tongue, and he felt her wrist. He shook his head sadly and said, "You have a bad case, a very bad case."
"Of what?"
"Growing up." Growing up spoiled a lot of things. It spoiled the nice game they had when there was nothing to eat in the house. When money gave out and food ran low, Katie and the children pretended they were explorers discovering the North Pole and had been trapped by a blizzard in a cave with just a little food. They had to make it last till help came. Mama divided up what food there was in the cupboard and called it rations, and when the children were still hungry after a meal, she'd say, "Courage, my men. Help will come soon." When some money came in and Mama bought a lot of groceries, she bought a little cake as celebration, and she'd stick a penny flag in it and say, "We made it, men. We got to the North Pole." One day, after one of those rescues, Francie asked Mama, "When explorers get hungry and suffer like that, it's for a reason. Something big comes out of it. They discover the North Pole. But what big thing comes out of us being hungry like that?" Katie looked tired all of a sudden. She said something Francie didn't understand at the time. She said, "You found the catch in it." Growing up spoiled the theater for Francie. Well, not the theater exactly, but the plays. She found she was becoming dissatisfied with the way things just happened in the nick of time. Francie loved the theater dearly. She had once wanted to be a hand organ lady, then a school teacher. After her first communion, she wanted to be a nun. At 11, she wanted to be an actress. If the Williamsburg kids knew nothing else, they knew their theater. In those days, there were many good stock companies in the neighborhood. Blaney's, Corse Peyton's, and Phillips Lyceum. The Lyceum was just around the corner. Local residents called it first the Lice, and then changed that into the Louse. Francie went there every Saturday afternoon, except when it was closed for the summer, when she could scrape up a dime. She sat in the gallery and often waited in line an hour before the show opened in order to get a seat in the first row. She was in love with Harold Clarence, the leading man. She waited at the stage door after the Saturday matinee and followed him to the shabby brownstone house where he lived untheatrically in a modest furnished room. Even on the street, he had the stiff-legged walk of the old-time actor, and his face was baby pink, as though he still had juvenile grease paint on it. He walked stiff-leggedly and leisurely, looking neither to right nor left, and smoking an important-looking cigar, which he threw away before he entered the house, as his landlady did not permit the great man to smoke in her rooms. Francie stood at the curb, looking down reverently at the discarded butt. She took the paper ring off it and wore it for a week, pretending it was his engagement ring to her. One Saturday, Harold and his company put on The Minister's Sweetheart, in which the handsome village minister was in love with Jerry Morehouse, the leading lady. Somehow, the heroine had to seek work in a grocery store. There was a villainess also in love with the handsome young minister, and out to get the heroine. She swaggered into the store in her un-village-like furs and diamonds and regally ordered a pound of coffee. There was a dreadful moment when she uttered the fatal words, "Grind it!" The audience groaned. It had been planted that the delicate, beautiful heroine wasn't strong enough to turn the great wheel. It had also been planted that her job was contingent on her being able to grind coffee. She struggled like anything, but couldn't get the wheel to go round even once. She pleaded with the villainess, told her how much she needed the job. The villainess repeated, "Grind it!" When all seemed lost, handsome Harold entered with his pink face and his clerical garb. Taking in the situation, he threw his wide minister's hat clear across the stage in a dramatic but unseemly gesture, stepped stiff-leggedly to the machine, and ground the coffee and thus saved the heroine. There was an awed silence as the odor of freshly ground coffee permeated the theater. Then bedlam broke loose. Real coffee? Realism in the theater? Everyone had seen coffee ground 1,000 times, but on the stage it was a revolutionary thing. The villainess gnashed her teeth and said, "Foiled again!" Harold embraced Jerry, making her face upstage, and the curtain came down. During intermission, Francie did not join the other kids in the interim pastime of spitting down on the plutocrats in the 30-cent orchestra seats. Instead, She pondered over the situation at Curtin. All very well and good that the hero came in the nick of time to grind the coffee. If he hadn't dropped in, what then? The heroine would have been discharged. All right, and so what? After she got hungry enough, she'd go out and find another job. She'd go out scrubbing floors like Mama, or graft chop suey off of her men friends like Floss Gaddis did. The grocery store job was important only because it said so in the play. She wasn't satisfied with the play she saw the following Saturday either. All right, the long-lost lover came home just in time to pay the mortgage. What if he had been held up and couldn't make it? The landlord would have had to give them 30 days to get out. At least that's how it was in Brooklyn. In that month, something might turn up. If it didn't and they had to get out, well, they'd have to make the best of it. The pretty heroine would have to get on piecework in the factory. Her sensitive brother would have to go out peddling papers. The mother would have to do cleaning by the day. But they'd live. You betcha they'd live, thought Francie grimly. It takes a lot of doing to die. Francie couldn't understand why the heroine didn't marry the villain. It would solve the rent problem, and surely a man who loved her so much that he was willing to go through all kinds of fuss because she wouldn't have him wasn't a man to ignore. At least, he was around while the hero was off on a wild goose chase. She wrote her own third act to that play. What would happen if? She wrote it out in conversations and found it a remarkably easy way of writing. In a story, you had to explain why people were the way they were, but when you wrote in conversation, you didn't have to do that because the things that people said explained what they were. Francie had no trouble selling herself on dialogue. Once more, she changed her mind about what profession she'd follow. She decided she wouldn't be an actress after all. She'd be a writer of plays. In the summer of that same year, Johnny got the notion that his children were growing up ignorant of the great ocean that washed the shores of Brooklyn. Johnny felt that they ought to go out to sea in a ship. So he decided to take them for a rowboat ride at Canarsie and do a little deep-sea fishing on the side. He had never gone fishing, and he'd never been in a rowboat, but that's the idea he got. Weirdly tied up with this idea, and by a reasoning process known only to Johnny, was the idea of taking little Tilly along on the trip. Little Tilly was the 4-year-old child of neighbors whom he had never met. In fact, he had never seen little Tilly, but he got this idea that he had to make something up to her on account of her brother Gussie. It all tied up with the notion of going to Canarsie. Gussie, a boy of 6, was a murky legend in the neighborhood, a tough little hellion with an overdeveloped underlip. He had been born like other babies and nursed at his mother's great breasts. But there, all resemblance to any child, living or dead, ceased. His mother tried to wean him when he was 9 months old, but Gussie wouldn't stand for it. Denied the breast, he refused a bottle, food, or water. He lay in his crib and whimpered. His mother, fearful that he would starve, resumed nursing him. He sucked contentedly, refusing all other food, and lived off his mother's milk until he was nearly 2 years old. The milk stopped then because his mother was with child again. Gussie sulked and bided his time for 9 long months. He refused cow's milk in any form or container and took to drinking black coffee. Little Tilly was born, and the mother flowed with milk again. Gussie went into hysterics the first time he saw the baby nursing. He lay on the floor screaming and banging his head. He wouldn't eat for 4 days, and he refused to go to the toilet. He got haggard, and his mother got frightened. She thought it wouldn't do any harm to give him the breast just once. That was her big mistake. He was like a dope fiend getting the stuff after a long period of deprivation. He wouldn't let go. He took all of his mother's milk from that time on, and little Tilly, a sickly baby, had to go on the bottle. Gussie was 3 years old at this time, and big for his age. Like other boys, he wore knee pants and heavy shoes with brass toe tips. As soon as he saw his mother unbutton her dress, he ran to her. He stood up while nursing, an elbow on his mother's knee, his feet crossed jauntily, and his eyes roving around the room. Standing to nurse was not such a remarkable feat, as his mother's breasts were mountainous and practically rested in her lap when released. Gussie was indeed a fearful sight nursing that way, and he looked not unlike a man with his foot on a bar rail, smoking a fat, pale cigar. The neighbors found out about Gussie and discussed his pathological state in hushed whispers. Gussie's father got so that he wouldn't sleep with his wife. He said that she bred monsters. The poor woman figured and figured on a way to wean Gussie. He was too big to nurse, she decided. He was going for 4. She was afraid his second teeth wouldn't come in straight. One day she took a can of stove blackening and the brush and closed herself in the bedroom where she copiously blackened her left breast with the stove polish. With a lipstick, she drew a wide, ugly mouth with frightening teeth in the vicinity of the nipple. She buttoned her dress and went into the kitchen and sat in her nursing rocker near the window. When Gussie saw her, he threw the dice with which he had been playing under the washtubs and trotted over for feeding. He crossed his feet, planted his elbow on her knee, and waited.
"Gussie want titty?" asked his mother wheedlingly.
"Yep."
"All right, Gussie's gotta get nice titty."
Suddenly, she ripped open her dress and thrust the horribly made-up breast into his face. Gussie was paralyzed with fright for a moment, then he ran away screaming and hid under the bed where he stayed for 24 hours. He came out at last, trembling. He went back to drinking black coffee and shuddered every time his eyes went to his mother's bosom. Gussie was weaned. The mother reported her success all over the neighborhood. It started a new fashion in weaning called giving the baby the Gussie. Johnny heard the story and contemptuously dismissed Gussie from his mind. He was concerned about little Tilly. He thought she had been cheated out of something very important and might grow up thwarted. He got a notion that a boat ride off the Canarsie shore might wipe out some of the wrong her unnatural brother had done her. He sent Francie around to ask could little Tilly go with them. The harassed mother consented happily. The next Sunday, Johnny and the three children set out for Canarsie. Francie was 11 years old, nearly 10, and little Tilly well past 3. Johnny wore his tuxedo and derby and a fresh collar and dickie. Francie and Neely wore their everyday clothes. Little Tilly's mother, in honor of the day, had dressed her up in a cheap but fancy lace dress trimmed with dark pink ribbon. On the trolley ride out, they sat in the front seat, and Johnny made friends with the motorman, and they talked politics. They got off at the last stop, which was Canarsie, and found their way to a little wharf, on which was a tiny shack. A couple of waterlogged rowboats bobbed up and down on the frayed ropes, which held them to the wharf. A sign over the shack read, "Fishing tackle and boats for rent." Underneath was a bigger sign which said, "Fresh fish to take home for sale here." Johnny negotiated with the man and, as was his way, made a friend of him. The man invited him into the shack for an eye-opener, saying that he himself only used the stuff for a nightcap. While Johnny was inside getting his eyes opened, Neely and Francie pondered how a nightcap could also be an eye-opener. Little Tilly stood there in her lace dress and said nothing. Johnny came out with a fishing pole and a rusty tin can filled with worms in mud. The friendly man untied the rope from the least sorry of the rowboats, put the rope in Johnny's hand, wished him luck, and went back to his shack. Johnny put the fishing stuff into the bottom of the boat and helped the children in. Then he crouched on the wharf, the bit of rope in his hand, and gave instructions about boats. "There is always a wrong and a right way to get on a boat," said Johnny, who had never been on any boat except an excursion boat once. "The right way is to give the boat a shove and then jump in it before it drifts out to sea. Like this." He straightened up, pushed the boat from him, leaped, and fell into the water. The petrified children stared at him. A second before, Papa had been standing on the dock above them. Now he was below them in the water. The water came to his neck, and his small wax mustache and derby hat were in the clear. His derby was still straight on his forehead. Johnny, as surprised as the children, stared at them a moment before he said, "Don't any of you damn kids dare to laugh." He climbed into the boat, almost upsetting it. They didn't dare laugh aloud, but Francie laughed so hard inside that her ribs hurt. Neely was afraid to look at his sister. He knew that if their eyes met, he'd burst out laughing. Little Tilly said nothing. Johnny's collar and dickie were a sodden, paperish mess. He stripped them off and threw them overboard. He rowed out to sea waveringly, but with silent dignity. When he came to what he thought was a likely spot, he announced that he was going to drop anchor. The children were disappointed when they discovered that the romantic phrase simply meant that you threw a lump of iron attached to a rope overboard. Horrified, they watched Papa squeamishly impale a muddy worm on the hook. The fishing started. It consisted in baiting the hook, casting it dramatically, waiting a while, pulling it up minus worm and fish, and starting the whole thing over again. The sun grew bright and hot. Johnny's tuxedo dried to a stiff, wrinkled, greenish outfit. The children started to get a whopping case of sunburn. After what seemed hours, Papa announced to their intense relief and happiness that it was time to eat. He wound up the tackle, put it away, pulled up the anchor, and made for the wharf. The boat seemed to go in a circle, which made the wharf get further away. Finally, they made shore a few hundred yards further down. Johnny tied up the boat, told the children to wait in it, and went ashore. He said he was going to treat them to a nice lunch. He came back after a while, walking sideways, carrying hot dogs, huckleberry pie, and strawberry pop. They sat in the rocking boat tied to the rotting wharf, looked down into the slimy green water that smelled of decaying fish, and ate. Johnny had had a few drinks ashore, which made him sorry that he had hollered at the kids. He told them they could laugh at his falling into the water if they wanted to, but somehow they couldn't bring up a laugh. The time was past for that. Papa was very cheerful, Francie thought.
"This is the life," he said, "away from the maddening crowd. Ah, there's nothing like going down to the sea in a ship. We're getting away from it all," he ended up cryptically.
After their amazing lunch, Johnny rowed them out to sea again. Perspiration poured down from under his derby, and the wax in the points of his mustache melted, causing the neat adornment to change into disorganized hair on his upper lip. He felt fine. He sang lustily as he rowed. "Sailing, sailing, over the bounding main." He rowed and rowed and kept going around in a circle and never did get out to sea. Eventually, his hands got so blistered that he didn't feel like rowing anymore. Dramatically, he announced that he was going to pull for the shore. He pulled and pulled and finally made it by rowing in smaller and smaller circles and making the circles come near the wharf. He never noticed that the three children were pea-green in the spots where they were not beet red from the sunburn. If he had only known it, the hot dogs, huckleberry pie, strawberry pop, and worms squirming on the hook weren't doing them much good. At the wharf, he leaped to the dock, and the children followed his example. All made it excepting Tilly, who fell into the water. Johnny threw himself flat on the dock, reached in, and fished her out. Little Tilly stood there, her lace dress wet and ruined, but she said nothing. Although it was a broiling hot day, Johnny peeled off his tuxedo jacket, knelt down, and wrapped it around the child. The arms dragged in the sand. Then Johnny took her up in his arms and strode up and down the dock, patting her back soothingly and singing her a lullaby. Little Tilly didn't understand a thing of all that happened that day. She didn't understand why she had been put into a boat, why she had fallen into the water, or why the man was making such a fuss over her. She said nothing. When Johnny felt that she was comforted, he set her down and went into the shack, where he had either an eye-opener or a nightcap. He bought 3 flounders from the man for a quarter. He came out with the wet fish wrapped in a newspaper. He told his children that he had promised to bring home some fresh-caught fish to Mama. "The principal thing," said Papa, "is that I am bringing home fish that were caught at Canarsie. It makes no difference who caught them. The point is that we went fishing and we're bringing home fish." His children knew that he wanted Mama to think he caught the fish. Papa didn't ask them to lie. He just asked them not to be too fussy about the truth. The children understood. They boarded one of those trolley cars that had 2 long benches facing each other. They made a queer row. First there was Johnny, in green wrinkled salt-stiff pants, an undershirt full of big holes, a derby hat, and a disorderly mustache. Next came little Tilly swallowed up in his coat, with salt water dripping from under it, and forming a brackish pool on the floor. Francie and Neely came next. Their faces were brick red, and they sat very rigid, trying not to be sick. People got on the car, sat across from them, and stared curiously. Johnny sat upright, the fish in his lap, trying not to think of the holes in his exposed undershirt. He looked over the heads of the passengers, pretending to study an Ex-Lax advertisement. More people got on. The car got crowded, but no one would sit next to them. Finally, one of the fish worked its way out of the sodden newspaper and fell on the floor, where it lay slimily in the dust. It was too much for little Tilly. She looked into the fish's glazed eye, said nothing, but vomited silently and thoroughly all over Johnny's tuxedo jacket. Francie and Neely, as if waiting for that cue, also threw up. Johnny sat there with 2 exposed fish in his lap, 1 at his feet, and kept staring at the ad. He didn't know what else to do. When the grisly trip was ended, Johnny took Tilly home, feeling that his was the responsibility of explaining. The mother never gave him a chance to explain. She screamed when she saw her dripping, befouled child. She snatched the coat off, threw it into Johnny's face, and called him a Jack the Ripper. Johnny tried and tried to explain, but she wouldn't listen. Little Tilly said nothing. Finally, Johnny got a word in edgewise.
Lady, I think your little girl has lost her speech.
Whereupon the mother went into hysterics.
You did it! You did it!
She screamed at Johnny.
Can't you make her say something?
The mother grabbed the child and shook her and shook her.
Speak! She screamed. Say something!
Finally, little Tilly opened her mouth, smiled happily, and said,
Thanks.
Katie gave Johnny a tongue-lashing and said that he wasn't fit to have children. The children in question were alternating between the chills and hot flashes of a bad case of sunburn. Katie nearly cried when she saw the ruin of Johnny's only suit. It would cost a dollar to get it clean, steamed, and pressed, and she knew it would never be the same again. As for the fish, they were found to be in an advanced state of decay and had to be thrown into the garbage can. The children went to bed. Between chills and fever and bouts of nausea, they buried their heads under the covers and laughed silently and bed-shakingly at the remembrance of Papa standing in the water. Johnny sat at the kitchen window until far into the night, trying to figure out why everything had been so wrong. He had sung many a song about ships and going down to the sea in them, with a heave-ho and a heave-to. He wondered why it hadn't turned out the way it said in songs. The children should have returned exhilarated and with a deep and abiding love for the sea, and he should have returned with a fine mess of fish. Why, oh why, hadn't it turned out the way it did in a song? Why did there have to be his blistered hands and his spoiled suit and sunburn and rotting fish and nausea? Why didn't little Tilly's mother understand the intention and overlook the result? He couldn't figure it out. He couldn't figure it out. The songs of the sea had betrayed him. Today, I am a woman, wrote Francie in her diary in the summer when she was 13. She looked at the sentence and absently scratched a mosquito bite on her bare leg. She looked down on her long, thin, and as yet formless legs. She crossed out the sentence and started over. Soon, I shall become a woman. She looked down on her chest, which was as flat as a washboard, and ripped the page out of the book. She started fresh on a new page. Intolerance, she wrote, pressing down hard on the pencil, is a thing that causes war, pogroms, crucifixions, lynchings, and makes people cruel to little children and to each other. It is responsible for most of the viciousness, violence, terror, and heart and soul breaking of the world. She read the words over aloud. They sounded like words that came in a can. The freshness was cooked out of them. She closed the book and put it away. That summer Saturday was a day that should have gone down in her diary as one of the happiest days of her life. She saw her name in print for the first time. The school got out a magazine at the end of the year in which the best story written in composition class from each grade was published. Francie's composition, called Wintertime, had been chosen as the best of the seventh-grade work. The magazine cost a dime, and Francie had had to wait until Saturday to get it. School closed for the summer the day before, and Francie worried that she wouldn't get the magazine. But Mr. Jensen said he'd be working around on Saturday, and if she brought the dime over, he'd give her a copy. Now, in the early afternoon, she stood in front of her door with the magazine open to the page of her story. She hoped someone would come along to whom she could show it. She had shown it to Mama at lunchtime, but Mama had to get back to work and didn't have time to read it. At least five times during lunch, Francie mentioned that she had a story published. At last, Mama said, "Yes, yes, I know. I saw it all coming. There'll be more stories printed, and you'll get used to it. Now don't let it go to your head. There are dishes to be washed." Papa was at Union headquarters. He wouldn't see the story till Sunday, but Francie knew he'd be pleased. So she stood on the street with her glory tucked under her arm. She couldn't let the magazine out of her hands even for a moment. From time to time she'd glance at her name in print, and the excitement about it never grew less. She saw a girl named Joanna come out of her house a few doors away. Joanna was taking her baby out for an airing in its carriage. A gasp came up from some housewives who had stopped to gossip on the sidewalk while going to and fro about their shopping. You see, Joanna was not married. She was a girl who had gotten into trouble. Her baby was illegitimate. Bastard was the word they used in the neighborhood. And these good women felt that Joanna had no right to act like a proud mother and bring her baby out into the light of day. They felt that she should have kept it hidden in some dark place. Francie was curious about Joanna and the baby. She had heard Mama and Papa talking about them. She stared at the baby when the carriage came by. It was a beautiful little thing sitting up happily in its carriage. Maybe Joanna was a bad girl, but certainly she kept her baby sweeter and daintier than these good women kept theirs. The baby wore a pretty frilled bonnet and a clean white dress and bib. The carriage cover was spotless and showed much loving handiwork in its embroidery. Joanna worked in a factory while her mother took care of the baby. The mother was too ashamed to take it out, so the baby got an airing only on weekends when Joanna wasn't working. Yes, Francie decided, it was a beautiful baby. It looked just like Joanna. Francie remembered how Papa had described her that day he and Mama were talking about her. "She has skin like a magnolia petal." Johnny had never seen a magnolia. "Her hair is as black as a raven's wing." He had never seen such a bird. "And her eyes are deep and dark like forest pools." He had never been in a forest, and the only pool he knew was where each man put in a dime and guessed what the Dodgers' score would be, and whoever guessed right got all the dimes. But he had described Joanna accurately. She was a beautiful girl.
"That may be," answered Katie, "but what good is her looks? They're a curse to the girl. I heard that her mother was never married, but had two children just the same, and now the mother's son is in Sing Sing, and her daughter has this baby. There must be bad blood all along the line, and no use getting sentimental about it."
"Of course," she added with a detachment of which she was astonishingly capable at times.
"It's none of my business. I don't need to do anything about it one way or the other. I don't need to go out and spit on the girl because she did wrong. Neither do I have to take her in my house and adopt her because she did wrong. She suffered as much pain bringing that child into the world as though she was married. If she's a good girl at heart, she'll learn from the pain and the shame, and she won't do it again. If she's naturally bad, it won't bother her the way people treat her. So if I was you, Johnny, I wouldn't feel too sorry for her." Suddenly she turned to Francie and said, "Let Joanna be a lesson to you." On this Saturday afternoon, Francie watched Joanna walk up and down and wondered in what way she was a lesson. Joanna acted proud about her baby. Was the lesson there? Joanna was only 17 and friendly, and she wanted everybody to be friendly with her. She smiled at the grim good women, but the smile went away when she saw that they answered her with frowns. She smiled at the little children playing on the street. Some smiled back. She smiled at Francie. Francie wanted to smile back, but didn't. Was the lesson that she mustn't be friendly with girls like Joanna? The good housewives, their arms filled with bags of vegetables and brown paper parcels of meat, seemed to have little to do that afternoon. They kept gathering into little knots and whispered to each other. The whispering stopped when Joanna came by and started up when she had passed. Each time Joanna passed, her cheeks got pinker, her head went higher, and her skirt flipped behind her more defiantly. She seemed to grow prettier and prouder as she walked. She stopped oftener than needed to adjust the baby's coverlet. She maddened the women by touching the baby's cheek and smiling tenderly at it. "How dare she? How dare she," they thought, "act as though she had a right to all that." Many of these good women had children which they brought up by scream and cuff. Many of them hated the husbands who lay by their sides at night. There was no longer high joy for them in the act of love. They endured the love-making rigidly, praying all the while that another child would not result. This bitter submissiveness made the man ugly and brutal. To most of them, the love act had become a brutality on both sides. The sooner over with, the better. They resented this girl because they felt this had not been so with her and the father of her child. Joanna recognized their hate, but wouldn't cringe before it. She would not give in and take the baby indoors. Something had to give. The women broke first. They couldn't endure it any longer. They had to do something about it. The next time Joanna passed, a stringy woman called out,
"Ain't you ashamed of yourself?"
"What for?"
Joanna wanted to know. This infuriated the woman.
"What for?" she asks, she reported to the other women. "I'll tell you what for. Because you're a disgrace and a bum. You got no right to parade the streets with your bastard where innocent children can see you."
"I guess this is a free country," said Joanna.
"Not free for the likes of you. Get off the street. Get off the street. Try and make me. Get off the street, you whore," ordered the stringy woman.
The girl's voice trembled when she answered.
"Be careful what you're saying."
"We don't have to be careful what we say to no street walker," chipped in another woman.
A man passing by stopped a moment to take it in. He touched Joanna's arm.
"Look, sister, why don't you go home till these battle axes cool off? You can't win with them."
Joanna jerked her arm away.
You mind your own business.
I meant it in the right way, sister. Sorry. He walked on.
Why don't you go with him? Taunted the stringy woman. He might be good for a quarter.
The others laughed.
You're all jealous, said Joanna evenly.
She says we're jealous, reported the interlocutor. Jealous of what? You?
She said you as though it were the girl's name.
Jealous that men like me, that's what.
Lucky you're married already, she told the stringy one. You'd never get a man otherwise.
I bet your husband spits on you. Afterwards, I bet that's just what he does.
Bitch! You bitch! Screamed the stringy one hysterically.
Then, acting on an instinct which was strong even in Christ's day, she picked a stone out of the gutter and threw it at Joanna. It was the signal for the other women to start throwing stones. One droller than the rest threw a ball of horse manure. Some of the stones hit Joanna, but a sharp-pointed one missed and struck the baby's forehead. Immediately, a thin, clear trickle of blood ran down the baby's face and spotted its clean bib. The baby whimpered and held out its arms for its mother to pick it up. A few women, poised to throw the next stones, dropped them quietly back into the gutter. The baiting was all over. Suddenly the women were ashamed. They had not wanted to hurt the baby. They only wanted to drive Joanna off the street. They dispersed and went home quietly. Some children who had been standing around listening resumed their play. Joanna, crying now, lifted the baby from the carriage. The baby continued to whimper quietly as though it had no right to cry out loud. Joanna pressed her cheek to her baby's face, and her tears mixed with its blood. The women won. Joanna carried her baby into the house, not caring that the carriage stood in the middle of the sidewalk. And Francie had seen it all. Had seen it all. She had heard every word. She remembered how Joanna had smiled at her, and how she turned her head away without smiling back. Why hadn't she smiled back? Why hadn't she smiled back? Now she would suffer. She would suffer all the rest of her life, every time that she remembered that she had not smiled back. Some small boys started to play tag around the empty carriage, holding onto its sides and pulling it way over while being chased. Francie scattered them and wheeled the carriage over to Joanna's door and put the brake on. There was an unwritten law that nothing was to be molested that stood outside the door where it belonged. She was still holding the magazine with her story in it. She stood next to the braked carriage and looked at her name once more. Wintertime, by Frances Nolan. She wanted to do something, sacrifice something to pay for not having smiled at Joanna. She thought of her story. She was so proud of it, so eager to show Papa and Aunt Evie and Sissy. She wanted to keep it always to look at and to get that nice warm feeling when she looked at it. If she gave it away, there was no means by which she could get another copy. She slipped the magazine under the baby's pillow. She left it open at the page of her story. She saw some tiny drops of blood on the baby's snowy pillow. Again she saw the baby, the thin trickle of blood on its face, the way it held out its arms to be taken up. A wave of hurt broke over Francie and left her weak when it passed. Another wave came, broke, and receded. She found her way down to the cellar of her house and sat in the darkest corner on a heap of burlap sacks and waited while the hurt wave swept over her. As each wave spent itself and a new one gathered, she trembled. Tensely, she sat there waiting for them to stop. If they didn't stop, she'd have to die. She'd have to die. After a while, they came fainter, and there was a longer time between each one. She began to think. She was now getting her lesson from Joanna, but it was not the kind of lesson her mother meant. She remembered Joanna. Often at night on her way home from the library, she had passed Joanna's house and seen her and the boy standing close together in the narrow vestibule. She had seen the boy stroke Joanna's pretty hair tenderly, had seen how Joanna put up her hand to touch his cheek, and Joanna's face looked peaceful and dreamy in the light from the street lamp. Out of that beginning, then, had come the shame and the baby.
Why? Why? The beginning had seemed so tender and so right. Why?
She knew that one of the women stone throwers had had a baby only 3 months after her marriage. Francie had been one of the children standing at the curb watching the party leave for the church. She saw the bulge of pregnancy under the virginal veil of the bride as she stepped into the hired carriage. She saw the hand of the father close.